From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Well, it's been a week since the release of the so-called Nunes memo, which made public allegations by the House Intelligence Committee that the FBI, quote, may have relied on politically motivated or questionable sources, closed quote, to obtain a FISA warrant on Trump advisor Carter Page in the early phases of the FBI investigation into allegations of Russian interference in the 2016 election. Republicans hold a majority of the House Intel Committee seats, reflecting their majority in the House, and Democrats, claiming political bias in those findings, prepared their own memo, which, using the same FISA documents as the Nunes memo, is reported to contradict its findings. As of press time Thursday, that memo, the Schiff memo, after the ranking committee Democrat Adam Schiff, is on President Trump's desk, awaiting clearance from the FBI and the president's signature. But this past Monday, yet another memo, or more specifically, a two-page letter over an eight-page memo, was released by a pair of senators, Republicans Charles Grassley and Lindsey Graham. That letter requests that the FBI and Justice Department conduct a criminal investigation into Christopher Steele, the former British intelligence officer behind the controversial Trump dossier. Specifically, the two senators, Grassley, who chairs the Senate Committee on the Judiciary, charged with oversight of the Department of Justice, and Graham, who chairs the Judiciary Committee's Subcommittee on Crime and Terrorism, referred Steele's case to Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and FBI Director Christopher Wray for potential violations of 18 U.S. Code Section 1001, commonly referred to as making false statements. That section generally prohibits knowingly and willfully making false or fraudulent statements or concealing information from the federal government in any matter within its jurisdiction, even by merely denying guilt when asked by a federal agent. That last was the charge that former Trump National Security Advisor Michael Flynn pled guilty to. To help us parse all of the in-company fighting that's going on in the government and between the intel agencies, we spoke with Professor Ward Churchill, the academic, author, and political activist from Colorado. Among his most noted works are the books Agents of Repression, published in 1988, which describes a secret FBI war against the Black Panther Party and American Indian Movement, and the COINTELPRO papers, which was published in 1990. We spoke with Professor Churchill from his home in Colorado, by phone, Wednesday. Professor Churchill, it's a pleasure to have you on with us.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for asking me.
Looking at the spectacle of all of these people that have identified as progressives, that call themselves of the left, certainly that are described as lefties by the media, Fox particularly, but even MSNBC and CNN, that we're supposed to believe the FBI and the CIA with respect to Trump, Russia, God knows what else, and that people that speak against it are somehow, I don't know, there's a variety of things. You're involved in a red-brown coalition with fascists in Russia and a whole bunch of other stuff. I mean, you could give us a little history and a little context for all of this.
Well, I guess you could look to the 1950s. For similar absurdities when the liberal left bailed, condemning people who were actual radicals across the board. It's not a perfect parallel, but it's kind of revealing in a way that suddenly the FBI becomes champion in internal fights. In the eyes of self-styled progressives or lefties or whatever they think they are, the opposition to the Republican status quo, whatever that might be at time, okay. But it's a way of affirming essentially that status quo in which both sides are participants. So.
Yeah, right.
The idea that the House left, if you will, would embrace the FBI when it's a matter of convenience for them to make a point is unsurprising in the long sweep of things, although I think it comes as something of a shock to people who actually have politics and are not aware of the overall history, would find surprising. It should not come as a surprise. If you know your history, then it becomes obvious what's going on in a way. Understand that the same people who are cast as the left opposition in this framework have the liberals, if you will, although that's a term that really has kind of lost its meaning.
Right, like all of them, really.
Richard Nixon was more liberal than a lot of the people purporting to that title.
For sure. Yep.
At this point, all right?
Yep.
So we have this slippage in the meaning of terms, but the great sin of the FBI in most people's mind, insofar as they're aware of it, was the COINTELPRO operations that began in the 1950s and were formally terminated in 1971, but which have continued apace. We can get into that if you like. Mm. I mean, there actually are political operations going on. Mm. But the COINTELPRO stuff, which was attributed to J. Edgar Hoover, which commenced under Republican administration, the Eisenhower administration, in the 1950s, was supposedly continued without the knowledge of the succeeding Democratic administrations. In fact, they were informed. They were told as much as they wanted to know.
Right.
They want plausible deniability in all, whether it's Kennedy or Johnson or the various attorney generals, including Ramsey Clark, sad to say,
right,
basically signed off on them. So it served their interest to have actual radical or dissident opposition stifled in silence.
Mm.
Okay.
Yeah, so we have... Now, we have also, go ahead, I'm sorry, go.
Well, there's all this insinuation that somehow, by the Trumpians, that somehow or another the FBI is favoring the liberal left. Even so-called socialists, and he may be by some definition or another, like Bernie Sanders.
Right.
They're not favoring them. They were part of the, you know, those were personal comments that have been surfaced lately by individual employees of the FBI who might very well have been Republicans in the anybody but Trump camp, which was quite pronounced.
Right.
Memories are rather short.
Right.
The idea of punching holes in Trump's veneer or ridiculing the man and personal communications would not be inconsistent with Republican behavior only 18 months ago. So how that comes out to favoring Nancy Pelosi or Bernie Sanders or anybody else, they could very well have been supporting Ted Cruz as opposed to Trump.
Right.
You see.
Even at the convention, Cruz was even at the convention.
Going on right now.
Yeah. I mean, even at the convention, Cruz was, they held a press conference. There was a whole, you know, attack on Trump and pretty much the convention. So that, yes, that happened all the way up to at least up to the campaign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually is occurring. I mean, if you consider David Frum and some people,
right,
who are notable right wingers. You know, they're still pursuing that.
Yep. Lindsey Graham,
very consistent
McCain,
with that position. And maybe Frum's position has actually been somewhat transformed by the experience of seeing Trump elected. I'm not sure.
Yeah, right.
I can't speak for him, and I don't really care
yeah,
that
right.
much. But the point is, he still signifies himself as a sort of right-wing conservative, but a real conservative, whatever that's supposed to mean.
Right.
All right. And he's as critical of Trump as anybody.
Right. Right.
You'd have to have, in a sense, you're either being duplicitous or you need an instruction manual to tie your shoes in order to buy into Trump in any real sense at all.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And I would argue duplicity in most cases here. Trump's got an obvious interest in trying to spin it this way, but it's so transparent, like most of his stuff, that only fools or liars would buy in.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the thing that...
does not vindicate the FBI in any sense at all. It's a political police agency, but these are not his targets.
Right. Right, that's the thing. The thing I want to probe, because there's clearly a consensus among the entire political establishment, more or less, even the ones that are nestled up close to Trump out of political necessity. The moment they, you know, have an opportunity to take two steps away, you know, turn and fire. There's a unanimity there with also the in what we're seeing coming out of the FBI and the CIA. That to me is more troubling than Trump. I mean, one of the things that when people were talking about Trump being the next Hitler and, you know, rising up or whatever, even with the excitement of, you know, the crazies in the country, the overt poor white supremacists who actually don't get any benefit from white supremacy other than not getting pulled over or whatever, they don't get any of the money.
Benefits. It's just not material benefits. Yeah.
They don't get any of the cash.
Don't get cash. They get certain psychological benefits and things of that sort.
Right. But they're like
they
poorly paid.
Tend to be prone to being arrested and imprisoned as much and things like that.
Right.
For, you know.
Right. And they'll get shot as frequently.
Their situation's good. It's just that they profoundly misunderstand the nature of their situation, or they're perfectly willing to trade self-interest in order to deny any kind of benefit or opportunity for others who happen to be of a darker complexion.
And they're working real cheap for that. Right. But you know, aside from them, you know, the in order to have a Hitler, you not only need like the Krupps and everyone that were the ones, you know, is because people here neglect to mention when they talk about Hitler and Mussolini that Hitler was appointed chancellor by von Hindenburg, and Mussolini was appointed prime minister by Victor Emmanuel III or whatever, the king, you know, the king. Here, you know, Trump being elected, you know, on the margins like he was, and having, you know, these, they're a joke compared to the, you know, brown shirts, okay, that there was really no threat of Trump becoming Hitler with the entire establishment arrayed against him, or the bulk of it. And I'm interested in the role that the intelligence agencies are playing here, and particularly the choice of Russiagate as a weapon against Trump rather than the obvious, you know, arsenal of weapons that there are based on policy and his, you know, his life history. You know, what that means, and I wanted to kind of look at that in the context of the history of these intelligence agencies.
I'm not entirely sure, and I'm not sure that anybody is other than the players in this. The alignment would be the interpretation of national interest according to the Koch brothers and kindred spirits, Bilderbergers and so on. Mm. Okay, and that's been evolving for quite a long time. And I'm fairly certain that the Kochs would rather have less of a buffoon doing this.
Right.
I don't know if they find him personally appealing in any sense at all. The guy's a clown, but he's an effective clown. Mm. They'd rather have somebody more of their own ilk pulling the levers, except they are pulling the levers in a sense.
Right.
And that's an anti-democratic impulse to the maximum. I don't see how you could get more anti-democratic than the Kochs. Intentions, what it is they're pursuing and accomplishing to a certain extent. Right. That's been going on for a while. I think institutionally the FBI's position is somewhat different. It is a very important functioning component of the state interests of the U.S., however they may be defined. And there's concern, I'm not sure about with the Kochs, but there's concern, generally speaking, in the institutional matrix of the U.S. state, you know, about its position, U.S. position, vis-a-vis competing powers.
Right.
And there is a counterintelligence function, a real one, that was, you know, formally assigned to the FBI from the get-go. And that is to smoke out and neutralize agents of foreign powers. Now, it's generally taken to be spies, saboteurs, espionage agents, and so forth. But it's broader than that.
Reds. It was Reds at the beginning. Yeah.
Well, Reds, but it could also be fascists.
And it was also Marcus Garvey, too, by the way. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Although Marcus Garvey was a target of a somewhat different sort. He wasn't seen as representing the interests of a foreign power so much as he was undermining the status quo within the United States, the racial hierarchy and so forth. And they voiced, that's not a formally assigned responsibility of the FBI, but that was pursued from the get-go as well.
All right.
Before the FBI was the FBI, we're talking back in the Bureau of Investigation days. Okay, World War One parameters, you're getting into Garvey, and the Palmer raids, the repression of the so-called foreign anarchists and all of that.
Even before before J. Edgar even, or J. Edgar. But,
well, no, actually, it's not before J. Edgar. He came over and ran the General Intelligence Division.
Right.
was not known. He was not the director, but he was responsible for that in the things and compiled the files and so forth. He's a damn brilliant office clerk in a way.
Yeah.
You know, and as a bureaucrat, you got to give the man his due. He was very effective.
Yep.
But that was a political focus, counter-subversive focus, not counterintelligence, but counter-subversion from the get-go.
Right.
Now, those terms are conflated.
Yeah.
Counterintelligence, legally speaking, is a legitimate function. Counter-subversion, not so much.
Right.
In fact, it was illegal, a lot of what was done.
Right.
But, you know, there's I mentioned the endorsement under COINTELPRO, beginning with Eisenhower, carrying through. Well, it would have started Republican, gone through two iterations of Democratic control. And under Kennedy and Johnson, and then you end up with Nixon, and that's when it's called off. And Nixon had a notion of using the FBI in exactly the same fashion that it had been used before. I'll go to that in a moment, but in ways similar to what's being discussed here. And Hoover refused.
Right.
Having learned a lesson at very early phase of his career. Now, if you want a counterpart to the way what's being suggested, insinuated, claimed by the Trumpian right at the present time, you'd have to go back to the Harding administration in the early 1920s when this was actually done. The Attorney General was Harry Dougherty, who was about as corrupt as it was possible to be, flagrantly so, ultimately is driven from his position. Bribery is essentially established, okay, and the Bureau was directed by William Burns of the Burns Detective Agency, who was using the agents of the FBI essentially as an extension of his strike-busting anti-unionist activity. They were an augmenting force in a way.
A public-private partnership.
Yeah. But, you know, Dougherty and friends had a notion to discredit the people who were investigating them on the Teapot Dome scandal. It's more extensive than Teapot Dome, but basically that's the shorthand for it.
Right.
That would be like, this is a Republican administration. These are all Republicans, for whatever that means. And the opposition who was investigating them was headed by Montana Senator Democrat, Burton K. Wheeler, and they were trying to both smear him and to find some pretext for prosecuting, getting him impeached and prosecuted. So they burglarized his house and various other things and were caught out on that. And that's when you have Burns removed from the agency and Dougherty falls and J. Edgar Hoover, who was actually running the operation, to all intents and purposes, forswore it, said he had nothing to do with it, and promised to prevent the agency from ever doing anything like that again. And gets himself named director of the Bureau of Investigation by no less than Burton K. Wheeler engineered that, figuring he could control the guy now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess Hoover stayed for what? It was like 50 years or 60, whatever. It was some ridiculous term.
Yeah. He always remembered the lesson that you don't deploy your operatives. You can have surrogates. You can collaborate with them, you know, back channel collaboration with them. You can feed them information. You can do various things, but do not put the Bureau in a position of being accused of what it was that it was found to have perpetrated under Daugherty, which is why he refused Nixon. Really part of the Houston plan, as it was called at the time.
Right.
It was the White House minion who was trying to arrange this. And that did provoke controversy within the FBI at that time. You had the split between Hoover and the guy who ran COINTELPRO directly, William Solomon. Split off. Solomon got sacked, and Solomon went to work for the Nixon White House. So he was orchestrating a lot of the stuff out of the White House and figured to get himself eventually named FBI director as a result.
So you
do have that context back there, but, you know, I see no indication that there's been much use of the FBI in order to shape the outcome of elections and so forth. Other things have been done, clearly, but the FBI would not be the perpetrator. And the thing they're trying to hang now, which is this FISA warrant, I mean, this is bogus as a $3 bill, irrespective of the so-called Steele dossier and whether or not Isakoff was relying on it when he wrote the story that they used to corroborate. That's probably not good form, but the fact is there was already an FBI investigation going on with regard to Trump operatives that was based in Australian intelligence lead, if you will, that was provided directly from Australia, because this clown, I'm blocking on his name right now, one with a simple name.
Oh, Carter Page?
Yeah, Carter Page.
Yeah.
Have been bragging about all of his connections, you know, as somebody working with Trump people, all the connections he had, high connections, to Russian oligarchs and government officials and so on. Now, I mean, that's the predication for the FISA warrant right there.
Right.
So the Steele dossier would have come under, you know, I have no idea as to its accuracy and so forth. I've not seen the thing. Don't really much care. And in this context, it's marginal relevance at best, since it was additive.
Yeah. You know, it seems that, and it's my understanding of from looking at it from, you know, much greater distance, that the way J. Edgar Hoover looked at it was that I'm not going to involve myself in who sits in the chair. I just have a gun pointed at the chair. So whoever sits in it, you know, I have stuff on them. And they all knew that, right? That was, everybody knew
it. Well, it wasn't just having stuff on them. The functions that were being performed were in their interest,
either side, whether
it's Democrats or Republicans.
It maintains the institution itself, right? That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And all of the presidents, really, from, well, Woodrow Wilson, if you want to look at the Palmer raids, from Woodrow Wilson forward, every president realized the counter-subversion function being carried out by the FBI, not necessarily aware of the details, not wanting to know the details, actually.
Right.
Okay, that's the plausible deniability factor at work, a good political stance to have, but they were all approving of it. Every one of them.
Yeah.
And you don't have to go to J. Edgar Hoover's famous Rose Garden memo to you know, confirm that.
That's right.
That doesn't happen until the Roosevelt administration. He outs the memo he wrote to himself after the meeting, not the minutes of the meeting, but, you know, he twisted even what was in his memo to serve his own purposes. The fact is, it was probably a fairly factual recording of what was said, so he could remind them later in language clear enough to jog their memories of what they had said. All right? Not that they wouldn't deny it in public, but there's leverage in that. So the file memos are not unimportant.
Yeah.
So he performed the same function in support of the status quo as he understood the status quo, and that's the institutional character of the FBI straight through, the national interest. And there's a bedrock to that, since there's a consensus on it between the left and the right within that establishment framework, all right, from the earliest days of the Bureau. That's always been true.
Right.
And it's no reason to suspect it's changed now.
Finally, I guess there's going to be competing memos for whatever value that has, if any. Each side.
None.
Right. You know, these are, public relations exercises, in sort of presenting an abstract of an argument that can't be presented because it's top secret, and so you're bad and I'm good, all of that going on. Is there any historical precedent to this kind of game? Because it seems, I remember all of the stuff with Nixon and with the CIA and the FBI, and some of the things that were going on earlier than that. I was born in 1954, so, the things that I saw from 1962 on, that history, I'm kind of pretty familiar with. I don't know anything like this, where there are these factions that, are making competing presentations and speaking through factions in the government with, I've got these top secret pieces of information from the intel community as opposed to I've got those. Have you ever seen anything like this, or is there a historical precedent for this?
Not literally, although you would see some of that in the post-World War II era, where before Joe McCarthy stands up and says, his famous list of however many names,
Communist State Department,
working in the government,
right?
Okay, and then with Parnell Thomas and HUAC and Nixon's rise in that, and they're making all sorts of allegations about the Republican administration, about the Democratic administrations, really all through the 30s and right through the war, and including, by implication, the Truman administration that was in power at the time. And you got some responses, but not like the ones that are going on now.
Yeah. Okay. And not for nothing, while that was going on, Truman is passing the National Security Act and, creating the CIA and all this stuff.
The loyalty oath program and
yeah.
all of that. So again, there is a sort of a consensus, if you will. I mean, the accusations going back and forth. Essentially, the right wing of the Republicans was claiming that communist agents were running the State Department and so forth, and that was certainly being denied.
Right,
but it was a different sort. Than is the case now, and some of that may, in fact, be that publications were publications in those days, and you needed to have either control of a newspaper or be running some little rag that a couple hundred people read, or control of a radio station, which was pretty tightly controlled. TV wasn't even a major factor yet, as compared to what you have now with the blogosphere and all of that nonsense. So you've had the rise of that in the level of chatter, which is to say, in a way, distraction from what's actually going on.
And Professor Churchill will tell you exactly what that is in part two of that interview in our next edition of the CPR News. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.